Welcome back to another episode of the Ally from Corporate podcast. Today's guest is Siri Chalazi, and she's a very special guest. I'm very excited to have her. She is a senior researcher at the Women and Public Policy Program at Harvard Kennedy School and an internationally recognized expert in advancing women and promoting gender equality in organizations. She's also the co-author of Make Work Fair, Data-Driven Design for Real Results. And we're going to talk about one specific chapter in her book today and more things about what we can do as men and women and anything in between to make work more fair, and some of the tropes that we see at work, some of the trends that are maybe healthy versus not healthy, and some real-world applications and some real studies that have been done. So welcome, Siri. I'm so excited to have you today.
Thank you, Ally, for that wonderful and generous introduction. I'm thrilled to be here.
Awesome. So tell me, I always like to ask this at the beginning of my podcast episodes, how did you get started in this? Did you have some aha moment where you're like, I'm passionate about this, let me get involved? Or is this always kind of where your career was headed?
It's a great question. I would say I've been passionate about gender equality my whole life. It just never made any sense to me that whether you're born as a woman or a man or anything else should influence the things that you can do, the opportunities that you can have in life. It never seemed fair. But I did kind of have an aha moment as well, come to think of it. And that was actually when I graduated college and got my first full-time job in management consulting. And that was the moment when I experienced firsthand for the first time a lot of these gender biases and inequities that up until that point I'd only read about. You know, and this is 2010, so I'm thinking, oh, it's 2010. These problems must have been solved. Surely people are exaggerating. Surely it's just the women who entered the workplace in the 1980s that have gotten stuck there, you know, and haven't been able to update their mental model of what's actually going on. And here I go entering the workplace looking around going, wow, this really is still happening. And I just couldn't believe it. And I found it so outrageous. So that's what planted the seed for me to dedicate my career to closing these gender gaps and to making sure that we leave a much different world for the next generation.
That's so amazing. I'm glad that there are people like you, and I'm glad that there is you out there, because I've had probably 8 jobs in my 12-year career. And I believe that company culture is sometimes the worst behavior that is tolerated at a company. And sometimes it's really bad. And sometimes it's very good. And there are strict rules for what's okay and what's not okay and what will be tolerated versus what is not tolerated. And I've learned and grown to really appreciate the companies who set their foot down and say, you know what, this is not okay, and are not afraid to have the hard conversations. And, you know, on the one hand, I'm sorry that you've also worked for some companies that don't do that. But at the same time, it sounds like this has really inspired you and stoked the fire of your passion to co-author this book, Make Life Fair or Make Work Fair?
Probably make Work Fair.
Make Work Fair. But we spend a lot of our time at work, so it might seem like life is more fair when work is more fair. But
I think they're connected, you know, and it's interesting you mentioned that, actually, because life outside of work very much influences what happens at work, especially so when it comes to gender. We actually write in the book, so I co-authored this book with Iris Bennett, my colleague at Harvard Kennedy School, and we write that achieving gender equality at work is one side of the coin, whose other side is achieving gender equality at home. Because as long as women continue to do a disproportionate share of care work, not just for kids, but also for parents, for neighbors, for relatives, as well as other household management work, it's time, right? And that time is the ultimate equalizer, because we all only have 24 hours in the day. So that time has got to come from somewhere, which means that women have less time to spend at work. So it's actually, life and the workplace are very much intertwined.
Wow. I believe it. And I see that too. So I wanted to talk about one specific chapter of your book, which I recently purchased. I'm loving it. And
thank you.
If anybody wants to buy it, it's available on Amazon, right?
Amazon and everywhere books are sold.
Perfect. So chapter 9, let's talk about this. So chapter 9 is titled Career Advancement That Works for All. So when I read this chapter, I had a lot of different emotions. You have a lot of data in there, which I really appreciate, because sometimes when we talk about DEI and diversity, it seems sometimes that it's not backed up by data. Or sometimes I wonder, how are they quantifying these things? But your chapter 9 really goes into that. And you cite actual studies that have been done and their methods for collecting data. So first of all, I really appreciated that. But some parts of this chapter made me feel frustrated because I, like you said, I hate that this is still the way that things are at a lot of these companies. And I like that you talked about how some of these things can be changed and how they can be identified and how we can combat these things to make work more fair. So I have two quotes from that chapter that I wanted to go into detail about with you. So one of the quotes from that chapter says, "Women are more perceived as helpful than men, but that isn't a highly valued behavior." Mm-hmm. When I read that, I had to read it again because for me, I love when somebody describes me as helpful. But hearing that that's not necessarily a valued behavior made me feel like, well, then what am I trying to be helpful for? So tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So this was based on a study that was done in a specific organization looking at the content of their performance evaluation. So actually analyzing the write-ups that managers put forth about their employees and looking at how were people described. And one of the findings was exactly this, is women did get some positive feedback, but when they did, it tended to be on personality and collaboration related aspects, such as being helpful, which of course isn't the stuff that you get promoted on.
No.
You get promoted on delivering more revenue, leading a high impact project, bringing in more clients, like all these types of things. And that's one of the ways in which gender bias seeps into performance evaluations, is we tend to, and there's many other studies that show this as well, is when men receive feedback, it tends to be more based on their actual business performance.
Wow.
Whereas the feedback that women receive tends to be based on their personality, which makes it often more subjective because personality is harder to quantify and assess objectively than how many dollars of sales did you bring in, right? That's a much more objective metric. But it's also less relevant to your performance and to your advancement. Because, okay, it's great to hear that you're collaborative and friendly and helpful, but if what you need to do is bring in more clients and gain more visibility in front of senior management, you, as an employee, you want to know how you're tracking against those mission critical things. And when you're not getting feedback on those mission critical things, even if you're doing well, that can hurt your performance because you need to know where you stand.
Yes. And you mentioned mission critical things. And I want to give everybody a little bit of homework. I love giving homework on these podcast episodes. Whatever you do for work, whatever industry you're in, whatever your job title is, the next time you go to work, whether it's tomorrow or Monday or whenever, I want you to look at your calendar or your to-do list or maybe the portfolio of projects you're working on. And I want you to ask yourself, are these things mission critical? Am I doing more administrative tasks that are just more helpful, that are going to make work less friction for other people? Or am I doing things that really matter to the business's bottom line or that senior management looks at? So ask yourself that. And if it's unclear, you can ask your manager. You can say, hey, are these things important to you? And if they say, no, not really, don't keep working on them.
Can I add to that homework, Allie? Can I tack on a little extra assignment? Particularly if you're interested in advancing to the next level in your organization, go look up the performance evaluation criteria for your current role, as well as the next role that you aspire to have. And as you're looking at your calendar and taking stock of how you're spending your time, map that against the competencies of the next level and say, you know, if you need to provide evidence of strong client relationships, right? What about how you're spending your time is helping you to cultivate more client relationships? And if that's not there, then you need to create more time for those types of activities in order to be able to prove that you are qualified to take on the next level.
Yes.
And if those performance criteria don't exist, or they aren't accessible to you, then to your point, you got to go ask your manager. That's a sign of an organization where decision-making processes are not at the level where they should be. Because when these things are not formalized, when they're not written down, when they're not shared transparently with employees, that's when there's a lot of room for bias to come into decision-making.
Yes. Do you think that what you just described, this activity or this homework, do you think that is somewhat describing the difference between working smart versus working hard?
Yes. I think that's 100% a piece of it. You know, another thing that ties into this is so-called non-promotable work.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of research done showing that if you think of your organization, right, there are the mission critical things like sales and client relationships. And then there's all the other stuff that needs to happen and that is incredibly valuable, but is not a direct contributor to getting more sales done. It's things like cleaning the office kitchen, buying the birthday cake for the colleague whose birthday it is today, making the room reservation for the meeting, taking the meeting notes, sending out the calendar invitation for the meeting. Again, these things all need to happen. They make the workplace a more lovely place for all of us to work. But for most of us, those are not the things that we're going to get promoted on. And research shows very consistently that women are both asked to do more of this so-called non-promotable work. They also volunteer for it more, especially in mixed gender groups. We see a slightly different dynamic when it's just all women groups. Women are actually less likely to volunteer. But some of these gender stereotypical behaviors arise more in mixed groups. In one professional services firm, they looked at how people spent their time and found that women in 1 year spend on average 200 hours more on non-promotable work.
What? That's too much.
So that 200 hours per year is coming directly from the so-called promotable work or glamour work that they could be doing. The sexy stuff that will get you noticed and promoted and advanced to the next level.
And
so that's another thing that I would be very watchful of as you think about how you spend your time, but also as you look around to your team, right? That's right. We have our weekly meeting. Well, who does send out the calendar invitation? Who does put together the agenda? Is someone tasked with taking the meeting notes? Is it a woman? Is it always the same person? Could we start rotating some of these administrating responsibilities? Or if we have an actual executive assistant type person for whom it is promotable work to take meeting notes and room reservations, you know, could we shift it onto their plate?
I love the idea of rotating. I was going to say that, but you took the words right out of my mouth. If you're a manager listening to this, or if you're a meeting host and you ask somebody regularly to take notes, pay attention to you if you ask the same person every time because they're good at it, because they volunteer, yes, because they're always there and they're always willing. For me, I used to be asked to take notes in meetings. And at first I found it as a sense of pride, like, oh, they think I take good notes. Great. But then I started realizing, wait, when I take notes in the meetings, I'm not able to pay attention as much. And so I'm not even able to contribute. Yeah. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. So I love the idea of rotating. All right. I have another quote from chapter 9. Let me read this one to you. So you said, even when we accept women as leaders, we tend to have gendered expectations of them. Mm-hmm. So I have an example of how this happened to me recently at my job. So I was in a meeting and I was the only woman. There were 5 other men in the meeting and this was in person. Mm-hmm. And I was not having a particularly great day. I remember just being like, okay, let me go to this meeting. I'll just sit and listen. And halfway through the meeting, one of the men looks across the table at me and silently, he makes a motion for me to smile. He kind of draws a smile with his fingers on his face.
Wow.
And he mouths to me, smile. And I looked at him and I didn't know what to do. Like, I didn't mm-hmm. want to be rude. So I kind of just gave a little smirk. But after the meeting, he took me aside and he said, hey, are you okay today? And I said, yeah, I'm fine. Why? And he goes, well, you kind of had a resting bitch face in that meeting. And I said, wow. What? Excuse me? And I said, well, all of the other men in the meeting were not smiling. Why are you saying this to me? And he said, well, you usually have a smile on your face and you usually have a really bright personality, which we appreciate in the office. And so it would have been nice to see you look a little happier. What do you think about that?
Oh my gosh. Well, first of all, my heart breaks for you and my angry feminist comes out as I hear this, right? It's just so frustrating that women are still having to deal with this. And I think everybody listening to this can see that when men don't have to deal with these types of comments, right? And deal with this kind of scrutiny and expectations, it just makes work a lot easier for them. This is one less extraneous thing that has nothing to do with their own performance and the company's performance that they don't have to spend time and effort and energy dealing with. that women do have to spend time and energy and effort dealing with. And that's one of the ways in which the playing field is still stacked against women at work. It's obviously an instance of gender bias, right? And a classic example of what you highlighted, one of those quotes from the chapter, that even though we've come a long way in having more women in the workplace, we have more women as role models, we still hold women and men to different standards. And there's a lot of research that backs up exactly how this happens. And one of the phenomena is that when women and men are behaving differently, like keeping a straight face in a meeting, it's just received differently. For the men, we say, oh yeah, he's focused, it's cool. And for the woman, we say, what's wrong with you?
Right.
We like that you're bubbly. Please be bubbly to make us happy. And of course, your job as a woman in the workplace, as any person in the workplace, is not to make your colleagues happy.
No.
It's to make the company successful, to deliver on your organization's mission. And part of where this comes from is the so-called competence likability dilemma or competence likability trade-off.
Yes.
It's a phenomenon that's well documented in research. And it stems from the fact that our stereotypes of what leaders are like and what leadership entails. I mean, Ellie, you tell me, right? You don't have to be an academic research to know these things because we all live in the world. What are our stereotypes of good leaders?
For men or women? Or just in general?
Well, just in general, to start.
Confident. What else? Eloquent. I would say, I mean, having good leadership skills to me, maybe not emotional, objective.
That's right. Rational,
objective. I would say those things.
Probably also things like assertive, independent, you know, strong, even aggressive,
visionary,
decisive, visionary. There we have it, right? Now, if we think about what are the stereotypes of men, not even at work, just more broadly, right? Well, it's some same similar things: strong, aggressive, independent, leader-like,
right.
Takes charge, the front of the pack. Now, if we think about what are the gender stereotypes of women, right? What do we, and again, I'm not saying we consciously endorse these or think that this is the right way to for things to be, but we have all grown up surrounded by the same cultural conditioning, the same role models, the same media. So what are some of our stereotypes of women?
Nurturing, soft, creative, artistic, gentle, kind. Quiet,
yes.
Submissive.
Caring, collaborative. Exactly.
Agreeable.
Now we can immediately see the problem, right? The stereotypes of leadership are very neatly aligned with stereotypes of men. So when men are in positions of leadership, there's just congruence. It all matches up. But the stereotypes of what women are like and what they're supposed to be like are actually very much so in conflict with the stereotypes of leaders. Because leaders are supposed to be strong and aggressive, and women are supposed to be, right, I'm putting this in air quotes, warm and caring and submissive. And this is where the competence likability trade-off comes from, is when women behave in accordance with those feminine stereotypes, they're not viewed as leader-like. They're viewed as likable, but not competent. And when women behave in accordance with the leadership stereotypes, when they are strong and assertive and they are decisive and they call people out and they make difficult decisions and are unflappable, well, we find them competent because they're leader-like, but we also kind of don't like them because we're unsettled by the fact that they're violating those gender stereotypes.
Yeah.
And this is a problem that's unique for women because for men, there is not this conflict of expectations. And the only way to resolve the competence likability trade-off in the long run is for us to both broaden our definitions of who is a leader and what leadership looks like, because we all know leaders who aren't always the loudest and the most aggressive voice in the room who's pounding the table from the front.
Yeah.
We know that leadership can also be empathetic. Sometimes you lead from the back. Sometimes you lead by listening and guiding and coaching others rather than just dictating down edicts from the top. So the first thing we need to do is kind of broaden our understandings of what good leadership looks like. we also need to see a wider breadth of people in leadership roles. Women and men of all ages, of all different styles. Men also, I mean, there's many men who don't want to be that aggressive leader, but they might not feel like they have latitude to lead exactly the way that they want. So we need to just see more examples of different types of effective leadership in action.
Yeah, absolutely agree. And I know we've been talking a lot about gender, but I want to touch on race as well, because chapter 9 touches on race. I want to tell you an experience that I had that really opened my eyes. A few years ago, I had my very first Black female employee working underneath me on my team. And in her first month on the job, she took me aside. I think this was in one of our first one-on-ones. And she said, I want to let you know what it's like being a Black female engineer. And I said, please tell me, educate me. And she started to describe that sometimes she feels like people don't want her to succeed, or if she is succeeding, people look at her strange, like it's abnormal to see a Black female winning, she called it, or doing well. And I asked her, how can I support you? Thank you for educating me. Thank you for sharing all of this. What can I do as a leader in this team, in this department, and as somebody who is a supervisor for you, what can I do? And so the advice she gave me, or the ask, was to help her voice be heard if it's not being heard, help stand up for her in situations where I'm seeing her ideas be squashed or somebody speaking over her. And I loved that she gave me some of these insights, because I feel like I was completely blind to those. And I wish that somebody would have that conversation with every manager out there, because it really opened my eyes. So I was glad that you touched on race in that chapter also.
You know, and what I love about her response too was that she gave you very concrete actions, behavioral advice, right? Instead of just saying vaguely, oh, I want to feel like I'm included in things, I want to feel like I belong. Well, where do those feelings come from, right? Yeah. Like, how can we actually concretely, through the things we do every day, create an environment where people indeed feel like they're included and they belong? And that's my obsession too, as a behavioral scientist, is I am obsessed with concrete actions, right? What can people do on a daily basis? And actually, I would argue that a lot of the things that she flagged, they're just part of good leadership in general.
I agree.
Right? We know that under people who don't look the part, who are traditionally historically underrepresented, whether it's people of color, women of color, people with disabilities, veterans, any number members of any number of groups, they are more likely to be ignored, overlooked, interrupted in meetings, not given high profile assignments, not given access to leadership, senior leadership, and things like that. But as leaders, it's our job to foster a level playing field for everybody, right? And make sure that all of the people who report to you, regardless of their identity, regardless of their demographic characteristics, that they all have an opportunity to surface their ideas in meetings, that they all have an opportunity to, you know, present on behalf of the team or whatever it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was very grateful for her, and it really shaped me as a leader. So shout out to you. If you're listening, you know who you are. Okay, so let's pivot. I want to talk about your latest Harvard Business Review article from May 2nd, 2025. So it's titled, "To Make Your Workplace Fairer, Take Charge of Its Norms." So you wrote this with your co-author, right?
Yes.
Your book co-author.
With Iris.
Iris.
And it dovetails actually very nicely with the conversation that we've been having right now about culture. And how do we shape the type of environment that we want to live in? Because yes, we have organizational policies and processes that are written down in an employee handbook somewhere. Some of our people have read it. Most of our people haven't touched the handbook, right? And even if they read it, it was many years ago when they first entered the organization. So yes, the policies are important, but often what is an even bigger influence on our daily experience at work is actually the norms. The shared but typically unspoken understandings of what kind of behavior is acceptable here and what kind of behavior will not be tolerated. So things like, do meetings start and end on time? Do we accept interruptions? If you disagree with something that a more senior employee has said, is it okay to raise your objection or disagreement publicly? Or should you take that senior leader aside one-on-one after the fact? Or is it not okay to disagree with the senior leader at all, at any time? When you're new to an organization, you don't know any of those things.
Right.
But very quickly, after a few days or a few weeks, as you observe your colleagues in action, you absorb the norms of that particular environment around, you know, what is actually acceptable here.
Absolutely.
How do we behave?
Something that also stuck out in this article was the part about unusual suspects driving meaningful change. So people who break stereotypes, such as male leaders advocating for diversity. So I have another quick story of this happening, and I have not seen this a lot, but this was such an obvious moment and it was a little uncomfortable, and I wish this happened more often. So I was in a virtual meeting a couple years ago, and it was a very high level, high visibility meeting, and there were probably 7 people on the call, at least senior director level or above. I was asked to take notes. That's why I was invited. Anyways, there were half female vice presidents, half male vice presidents on this call, and there was a senior executive vice president who was a man. So there was a man with a slightly smaller title who was speaking, and he was talking about a girl at work. And the senior executive vice president interrupted him and said, "We would call her a woman, not a girl."
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who made the mistake said, "What?" And he said it again. We wouldn't call her a girl. We would call her a woman. And he said, "Oh, I'm sorry. Okay." And then he changed his language, finished his story, did not make the same mistake again. And I was looking at the cameras of the other women vice presidents on the call, and they looked, I don't want to say smug because that has kind of a negative connotation, but they looked very
vindicated,
satisfied.
Maybe.
Yes. They looked liberated. And I had chills, and I just thought, why? I was like, that was an uncomfortable moment, but I loved it. And I wish more male leaders like that would advocate for women or people of color or underrepresented groups, like you're mentioning. Because it was such a powerful moment, and it really spoke volumes about the company culture just in a single moment. It was awesome.
And it's a fantastic example of norm entrepreneurship in action, right? Because norm entrepreneurship is you taking the initiative to create and uphold the types of norms that you want to see. So if you want to live in a culture where women are not called girls but are treated with equal respect, you know, if someone, well, first of all, you're going to do that yourself. But then if you observe a colleague like that man in the meeting behaving contrary to that norm, you have to do something about it. If you're a norm entrepreneur, you can't just let it slide, but you have to actually uphold the positive norm. And I think some people would feel comfortable doing that one-on-one, taking the person aside after the meeting and saying, "Hey, you might not have even noticed, but at one point in that meeting just now, you actually referred to a colleague as a girl and, you know, blah, blah, blah." That's great. But it's incredibly powerful when we do these things publicly.
Yes.
Like the man did in this meeting, because it's both a powerful learning opportunity for this other male executive to not call women girls again, but it publicly signals and reinforces the norm, including to the other women and men present, that, hey, this is the kind of company that we want to work in. This is the kind of language that is acceptable to use here. This is the kind of language that's not going to fly.
Yep.
So whenever we're able to make those public interventions, they really are very powerful. And as you mentioned, there is research suggesting that when we advocate for a group that we are not ourselves a part of, we have more credibility.
Really?
In being this kind of norm entrepreneur. So when men advocate for women, right, there's not seen to be this self-interest at play.
Yes.
So we receive it better than when a woman is advocating for another woman or a person of color is advocating for another person of color. Because our response to that is, well, of course, you know, of course the women are always going to side with the women and they're going to try to support the cause of women. Whereas when it's a quote unquote unusual suspect that steps in, it kind of jolts us into action. It's just how human brains work.
And I love that you're saying that, because now that has me thinking, who can I advocate at work that I'm not a part of their group?
Exactly.
And in what ways can I advocate for people that I wouldn't even think of because I'm maybe not suffering the kind of things that they're suffering, but I'm still a witness to it. And I also love that you pointed out he didn't take that man aside one-on-one because he could have, and maybe some people would have, but I love that he set the tone of the culture in that meeting and he didn't embarrass him. It wasn't embarrassing and it was very short and it didn't really disrupt the meeting too much. It was maybe a 30-second interaction, but I think it meant a lot more to the other people on the call to witness that than it would have them talking one-on-one afterwards. So I appreciate that.
And years later, you still remember it. Yes. Those two guys may well not even remember that this ever occurred, but it made a big, big difference, a big impact on many of the other people there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So switching gears here, you and I have talked about tropes before. I want to talk a little bit more about those tropes in the workplace. Can you give us some examples of things that we should look out for, things that are very common in terms of tropes in the workplace, in terms of maybe gender or underrepresented groups, that should maybe be signals to us to speak up or change our behavior in the future?
Yeah. So I think of tropes really as expressions of stereotypes, right? Where stereotypes, of course, are our sort of expectations of what an individual person is going to be like based on their membership in a group. So, oh, you're an American, Americans are loud. Oh, you're Asian, Asians are good at math, right? Well, yeah. Some Asians are and some Asians aren't. Mm-hmm. I know many quiet Americans. So we have these overgeneralizations of groups that might apply to some members of that group, but most definitely don't apply to all group members. There's 330 million or even more Americans, right? There's billions of women and men on the planet. They are, of course, not all alike. We all can intellectually understand this, but we often fall prey to assuming that when we meet someone or see somebody that we don't know very well, we quickly look at, oh, what country are you from? What gender are you? What race are you? And then we start assuming things about that person that we don't actually know. So that's when stereotypes influence our decision making, and stereotypes often lead us astray. So for me, one of the best ways to catch ourselves and to improve our decision making is to say, would this apply to the opposite? So when we talk about working mothers, that's a very common term, right? And people will even say, oh, I'm a working mom. Flip it to the opposite, which in this case would be a working dad. Is that a term that we have in our culture?
I've never heard somebody say that.
Is that a phrase that you've ever heard anyone use?
No.
You haven't, right?
Working dad,
so that,
no.
To me, is a flag that there's something stereotypical and gendered going on here because it doesn't apply to the opposite. Or, you know, if we if you're hiring and someone says, I'm an older candidate, they're really with the times. They're impressively good with technology. Pause and say, wait a second. If we had a 25-year-old candidate, would we ever say things like, yeah, they're impressively good with technology. I'm astonished that they're staying with the times.
No.
Again, that might be a signal that there's bias going on there. And we might have to dig deeper to say, is this a relevant thing to be even talking about? Is this something that we should factor into our decision making? Why are we commenting on this in the first place?
Okay. So when we hear common phrases like that, or maybe when other people are stereotyping or generalizing, we can try to flip it in our mind and say, would we ever say that about a Black person? Or would we ever say that about a woman instead? And if the answer is no.
Or in your meeting example, you know, do we ever refer to men in the workplace as boys?
No.
So if we refer women to women as girls. Exactly. So if we don't do that for men, well, we shouldn't be doing it for women either.
Yeah. Sometimes, so I have a morning meeting that I go to, and sometimes, most of the time, the leader of the meeting refers to the men as Mr. last name, but the women, they always call them by their first name. And I noticed we did that for, I think it was Donald Trump and Hillary, or, we called them Trump and Hillary, or Biden and, Kamala.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so what do you think about like using first names and last names? Is that kind of along what we're talking about?
I think there's evidence of that too, that it's actually a widespread phenomenon, that this has been documented. And again, I would say I don't personally feel strongly about whether it's the first name or the last name, you know, whether there's a title or not. Some people, of course, do feel strongly about these things, and we should always refer to people the way they prefer to be referred to. But let's just do the same thing for everybody.
Yeah.
If you agree to use titles, let's use everybody's titles. If we go with full names, let's use full names for everyone. There's just no reason to treat people differently.
Yeah. Love that. And that's kind of the overarching message of this episode, probably your book, your Harvard Business Review article. So I love that we're talking about this. And thank you so much for coming on this podcast and this episode.
It's
I hope this episode gets a bunch of views, because I know that every employee, every team, every department, every company, every industry could work at these things and get better. And again, the culture at a company is often felt as the worst behavior that's tolerated. And so if we can raise the bar there by making some of these changes that we mentioned here, I think that the workplace could be a better place for everybody. So before we end here, I know we talked a lot about your book, Make Work Fair. How else can people get a hold of you?
I'm quite active on LinkedIn, so I would love to connect with you there. I'm just Siri Shalazi, first name and last name. Iris, and I also have a newsletter, a Make Work Fair newsletter, where we share the latest research. The good news is new research is constantly being done, and we're learning more literally weekly about what are the things that work to create high-performing, fair companies with positive cultures, and what are the things that don't work. I think, by the way, insights on both sides are really important. It's important to know what to do. It's also important to know what not to do. So we share all those latest insights in our newsletter, and you can sign up for that on the website for our book, which is makeworkfair.com.
Awesome. That would be fun because, reading this book, you can read it and then put the book down, but like a newsletter that comes out regularly is very powerful because, like you said, there's data coming out all the time, and it also shows that people are continuously working at this conundrum that we find ourselves in at work. Yes. So, awesome. Yes. I'm so glad that you have a newsletter. So tell Iris hi. I'm sorry I couldn't meet her today, but sounds like she's a really great partner that you've been working
with. I definitely will. Oh, it's been wonderful. I mean, you know, in academia, we're all about collaboration. It's just how we work. Even when we run experiments, studies, do projects, we regularly have teams of 3, 4, 5, or even more people and co-authors on papers. And I found in my nearly a decade-long career in academia that it just invariably makes the output better.
Yeah.
When there's more smart minds and more pairs of eyes looking at something and bringing their different perspectives to bear, we just generate a better product. And that's definitely the case with the book as well.
Awesome. Well, I'm excited to continue reading it and finish it eventually. So thank you so much for being a guest on the Ally from Corporate podcast. And thanks everybody for tuning in. We will catch you in the next episode.
If you're looking for legit ways to make extra money, you've got to check out The Side Hustle Show. With hundreds of actionable episodes to choose from, you'll learn what's working now from real people making real money. Like the Utah mom who built a six-figure business playing video games, or the guy earning $3,000 a month renting out mobility scooters. Online or offline, from Amazon to your own hometown, from YouTube to vending machines, The Side Hustle Show has you and your wallet covered. Subscribe to The Side Hustle Show wherever you're listening to this podcast and increase your earning power today.